Now let's give a South County welcome to our main speaker. We've got Sarah A. from Studio City.
Hi guys, I'm Sarah Evley, I'm an alcoholic. Yay. First, I want to thank my dear friend Annette for having me come up to share with you guys. My husband spoke up here a couple years ago, and Annette and I hit it off. It's one of those friendships that you find in Alcoholics Anonymous where you just add water and it's just instant. That identification and sharing the same solution. And thank you. And I want to thank Mike again for an excellent 10 minutes. Broke it off real good. And I want to welcome you. There were several newcomers that stood up tonight, and I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the best deal around. And, you know, I came in, I drank and used for 30 years. And I was in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Rational Recovery, if everybody remembers that one, for 26 of those years. And I hope that that is not your experience. That was my experience, which is what I'm here to try to share with you guys tonight, a little bit about, you know, what I was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I want to welcome the Al-Anons. Yay! I'm coming up on 4 years. Double winner. So yeah, that popped up later on in sobriety. So anyway, the stats are, my sobriety date is November 27th of 2008. So I'm coming up on 11 years of sobriety. And that is not my first sobriety date. I've had millions. And so if you are coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous, or this isn't your first rodeo, I absolutely identify. And if this is your first time in Alcoholics Anonymous, that does not need to be your story. It's much easier to stay than it is to come back. And by the grace of God, I was allowed to make it back. I didn't die in the process. So my sponsor is Carla Rowell. I don't know if any of you, she was formerly Carla Moore. That woman absolutely saved my life and carried this message to me one small little spoonful at a time. And my home group is Pacific Group, which some of you may be familiar with. If you're ever down in LA and want to go hit the big Wednesday night meeting, by all means, look me up and I would love to show you around. It's the largest AA meeting in the world, and I'm there every Wednesday night. And so those three things, my sobriety date, my sponsor, my home group, and a loving God are the most important things in my life. You know, I was adopted at birth. I was born in the 60s, 1966. I was adopted at birth, and so right from the gate, I was not gonna fit in. So when people like would share at meetings about feeling like they never fit in, I really felt like that right from the beginning because I just felt lost. The parents that adopted me, my mother was a schizophrenic. And my father was a rageaholic, so our house was a little odd. It wasn't like other homes, and my mother was a hoarder just to top things off. Kids would come over to my house and want to know, what's all this stuff? And I'd go over to their house, and they'd be like, well, where is everything? You know, like the kitchen counters would be clear. And I'm so impressed with Annette's mother's home, I was still looking around like, God, where is everything? And it was that kind of household. I had an adopted brother, and there was just a lot of strange things going on. You know, I remember my first resentment was I couldn't have a Barbie because Barbie and Ken lived in sin, and because they weren't married. So I had a sunshine family, and I hated the sunshine family. Hated the sunshine family, and I was an awkward, geeky little kid. I was the small runt. I was the last one. picked for team anything. I mean, I was not a team player. I just loved to just sit at home, read my books, and go into fantasy. I had catastrophic thinking at a young child. As a young child, my favorite game to play was Tornado. And I would sit in my little box. We would get the boxes from, you know, the refrigerators or the dishwashers, and I would decorate the inside of my box. This is back in Michigan. I was born in Texas, grew up in Michigan. And I would just sit in there and be happy as pie in my little box with nobody bothering me, waiting for the big one to come. I carried that catastrophic. I still to this day love to play worst case scenario, you know? I see myself now as a survivalist. You can look in the back of my Subaru. I have everything in there to survive. I'm a survivor. So I knew something, you know, I'm not sure if I was born an alcoholic, but I definitely had some of the symptoms, right? And, you know, by the time I reached the age of 12, I was definitely ready for a drink. I didn't fit in anywhere. You know, things were awkward. I was a really good student. I had a lot of promise. I had talent. I played piano. And the minute I took that first drink with Lori Brooks, Lori Brooks' dad was a doctor, so they had an in-ground pool, which is rare in Michigan, and they had these festive parties. And back in the 70s, they had these ginormous liquor bottles that had squishy things on the top, and they just had booze all over their house. And so we took a little bit of everything and put it in a glass with some grape Kool-Aid, and we drank that down, and I don't know that I remember necessarily at that time the effect that alcohol produced, which I love, and why else would you drink? But I did remember that I became a part of something at last. I was a part of life at last. I had arrived, and I took off running right from the gate. And those graves, they, you know, Mike was talking about how his alcoholism just basically took away everything from him that was worthwhile, and that was my experience as well. All of a sudden, graves plummeted. I recently had to get I tried to find my high school transcripts, and I looked at them in my college ones, and it is an alcoholic transcript, right? And I was just looking for a party. I was looking for a party, and it was great. And, you know, we're in the 80s, and it was going on. And I had a lot of fun. I love the effect produced by alcohol. I love all types of alcohol, except for peppermint schnapps. I got so sick, and I still can't do peppermint candy to this day. yay, another one. Peach schnapps again in college. But I love everything about it. I love the glasses, I love the bottles, I don't care if it's a funnel and a hose, I don't, you know, or if it's a fancy glass and a bar, or if I'm just sitting there, as gross as it may sound, having to just try to throw it back and throwing up in a glass and drinking it back and throwing it up in a glass and throwing it back. Yeah, that's where my alcoholism took me. So, you know, like I said, immediately I was off to the races. By the age of 14, I let somebody stick a needle in my arm for the very first time. So, you know, my story does have a lot of outside issues, a lot of substances, but I am an alcoholic, I assure you, through and through. And so, you know, at the age of 16, you know, there'd been a lot of partying going on, and I was headed to continuation school, and I managed to manipulate my way into college, interestingly enough. And that was great, because I moved into the dorms at 17, and I was out of that crazy house, and it was party on. It was kamikaze night on Thursday night, it was ladies night on Friday nights, and then we had the frat parties on the weekends, and I barely was able to make it to any classes. I was barely able to do anything. I majored in alcoholism, I minored in men. And I had a great time. Now, mind you, my father was a professor at this university. The selfishness and self-centeredness of my disease shows up in that I just really don't ever take into consideration how my actions will affect you, or how they may cause you harm, or shame, or embarrassment, because it was just all about me. And my poor father had to hear back from his colleagues about his daughter through a series of stories. And I just take another drink and I forget all about it, you know? And I'm like, hey, you know, leave me alone, quit bothering me. Everybody was always down on me, you know, trying to be a buzzkill. And, you know, I had stumbled into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting for the first time at 16. I stayed sober for about 90 days. But, you know, the seed was planted. I knew that there was a place that I could go to. I just wasn't ready yet. Right? Not to mention that my mother was mortified by the fact that I had joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And because you just don't do that. Now, mind you, she's a schizophrenic taking so many pills that I don't know how she stood up straight. But her daughter was not going to be an alcoholic. So a couple years into college, you know, it was the 80s, there was this blizzard that had come from Peru and Colombia, up into the country via Miami, Michigan, straight up there, and I dropped out of college and I married my coke dealer. So I'm going to race through a little bit of this. You know, there were a lot of different things that happened. I like to get married. I like to get married a lot. So between my husband and I, we have 7 marriages, and I'm in the lead with 4. I tell them 2 of them don't count, and the only people who say that they don't count are people that have been married that many times. So. And so we got married and divorced in the same year. I went through my first of 19 different detoxes and rehabs that year. We went through the marriage because we thought, well, if we can make it through that, we can make it through anything. But apparently the only thing that we had in common was doing a lot of blow with one another. So, you know, they used to say in the meetings that, you know, no major changes in your first year. I don't hear that a lot anymore, but no major changes in your first year. So I got married and divorced. I started a new career as a travel agent. I moved to Chicago. I found my birth mother. Let's see, what else did I do in that time? And while I was in Chicago, I was going to meetings. I had gotten sober for a little bit. I had a sponsor. They said, you know, if you look for somebody that has what you want. She was she worked at the Playboy Club. She was adorable. There were a lot of hims and hers in my story as well. It didn't matter. Every Tom, Dick, and Mary. I didn't stay sober. Right? I didn't stay sober. I think I had about maybe 5 or 6 months of sobriety. That's the longest I'd ever had. And I was in a club. It was the 80s, right? And with no steps, no sponsor, no God, I'm going to pick up a drink. It's just a matter of time. And I was treating the program just like a social scene. That's what I thought it was. I really didn't understand anything about the steps at all. I didn't have any concept of any of it. I did see the word God, and I understood that a little bit. I had, you know, been brought up Episcopalian. I had gone to church. I stopped going to church when I broke into the church and stole the team, you know, the equipment, sound equipment from the teen room. I have made amends for that. But, you know, I had deep down inside of me a fundamental belief in God, right? And if that was enough, then I would have gotten sober because I've been dunked, I've been saved, I've been mikvahed, you name it. You know, I've had a Campus Crusade for Christ pounding on the door. You know, there were a lot of really wonderful people that have reached out to me in my years to try to help me to find a path to God, to help save me from basically myself and my disease. And it was only through the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous I was able to accomplish that and to find an actual relationship. It was one thing for me to go to church and pray, and I could do all of those things, but to truly, I needed a relationship with a higher power to be able to relieve me of the obsession to drink, amongst many other things. So, you know, I was in Chicago. It was great. It's a great drinking town. What can I say? it was still working for me. And I would stay out into the clubs until 4 o'clock in the morning, and then I would manage to make it home. I'd get about an hour or two of sleep, and I'd get up and I'd go to work. And it was at this time that I realized I really didn't have enough money to support everything that was going on. So I took up a little night job. So this was during the days of Pretty Woman, so I don't know if any of you know the movie. So I took up this little night job, and it was kind of exciting for a while, you know, and I basically, it was about fur coats, and it was fun, and I was young, and I would get flown to Europe first class, and then my alcoholism would take over, and I'd be shipped home cargo, basically. Because these poor unsuspecting men would realize that they had just, you know, encountered a raging alcoholic. And so I was not only nationwide with my alcoholism, I was international. And sweating it at customs every single time. So I took a trip and wound up in San Francisco. And I'll be real quick about this because I want to be able to get sober. My 20s, this was my 20s. I refound the punk rock scene. I had been a punk rocker when I was 13. And, you know, within a matter of years, I mean, it was great. You know, I finally said no to real jobs. I just said no. No real jobs because it interfered with my drinking and using. And I took to the streets, and it was all about rent strike and live fast, die young. And I looked a lot different than I do right now. I had a shaved head, tattoos everywhere, piercings. We had no accountability, no responsibility. I was a dumpster diver. You know, my friends were like Hollywood Mike and Alicia and Step On Me. And, you know, everybody had a nickname. And it was, you know, it was just wild and it was crazy. And then things started to get a little scary. People started to die. And I started to see the consequences of this disease. There was an AIDS epidemic that was going on. I had friends that were dying from that. There were overdoses, there were suicides. I had an attempted suicide when I was about 24, where I changed my mind at the last minute because who was going to take care of my cat and my bird? You know, just I was that crazy lady walking around with a cockatoo on her leather jacket with her Doc Martens all over San Francisco. You know, I ended up having a DUI. I took a car off an overpass in a blackout in Fremont. And the only thing that they have, I remember nothing from it, but the police report says that when I came to in the hospital, that I was deeply distressed because I thought that there was somebody else in the car. I didn't know. I'd lost a lot of friends in car accidents, you know, like 4 at a time, 5 at a time. And, you know, I was a blackout drinker. I was starting to have consequences. It wasn't so much fun anymore. And so I started to reach out and get help again. And I wound up going to a long-term rehab in Pasadena, one that had, like, signs around your neck and those types of things, digging your own grave with a spoon at 4 o'clock in the morning, behavioral modification type thing. And that's where I met him. And he was listening to Black Sabbath across the courtyard, and we locked eyes, and somebody had said he had a rich dad, so that helped. And yeah, I love the inventory process, because when I actually learned what self-seeking, what my motives were, I was like, oh my God, it was horrible. And we started this dance of death with one another, and you know, it was early on in our relationship, and I got pregnant, and I was about 4 months pregnant, and he relapsed. He went out, and I was really happy being sober. Every time I did get sober, I really, really enjoyed the rooms. I loved the love in the rooms. I felt something here, but I had made him my higher power. I had made him my higher power, and I followed him out, and I thought, well, it'll be okay, I'll just use this one time with him, because I didn't want to lose him. And instead I lost the baby. And, you know, they talk about you're only as sick as your secrets. And I don't know what your secret is that you brought into Alcoholics Anonymous or that you're holding now. That was mine. The shame and the guilt, my heart still pounds with it. The shame and the guilt of that, you know, I was adopted. I wanted a child of my own more than anything else in this world. And so the next 2 years of my life, I can't even recall, because there were not enough drugs and alcohol in the world to basically cover up what I had done, right? And I had gone back up to San Francisco, and I just became lost in a vast sea. In the big book, in Bill's story, there was a line, when I was new, there were just, and my sponsor took me through that book line by line. There were two parts that I could identify with when I was new. One was how dark it is before the dawn. And the other part was, we have found a way out. I was looking for a way out. I was always looking for a way out. I just didn't think that people like me could get sober. I thought sobriety was for you, but people like me were dying out there, and I saw it every single day. So he got out of prison. He came up and he picked me up, and we started on this journey again. And I managed to stay clean for about a year in another fellowship, because I felt that drugs were more of the issue. And I developed an eating disorder, which is important because, you know, if it's very common, and a lot of people don't talk about it in AA, but I know especially for women, if you've been living on Butterfingers and vodka, and the kindness of, you know, and generosity of somebody that buys you a burger at Hamburger Mary's once a week, you might develop an eating disorder, because nobody ever taught me how to eat. I had no tools for living. When I heard that you had no tools for living, I completely understood that. I didn't know how to pay a bill. I had never had an apartment. I'd never done a lease. I'd never turned. Magically, cars would appear and disappear, you know. You know, just, you know, I had no tools for living whatsoever. So I went to this therapist, and she knew a lot about eating disorders, but she didn't know about alcoholism. And so she told me one, and I talked about my addictions, and then she said one day, she goes, well, I don't see why you can't have a glass of wine on the weekends. Oh, I was like, she's so right. So, my daughter Hannah was born, and, you know, and Hannah means grace. And grace is a gift from God. I chose that name for a reason. And it was a window of opportunity. I know a lot of women that were never able to have children because their alcoholism took that away from them. There was this window, this little window, that we were able to have this beautiful, beautiful child. And I wanted to be the best mother in the world. You know, I loved that baby. And alcohol was still working. And it worked for a little while. But as it progressed, that glass of wine turned into a bigger glass. Pier One used to sell these glasses the size of a fishbowl. And so my husband would go to work. We had a construction company. And so he'd go to work all day, and I'd stay home with the baby. And it would fit half a glass of wine in it. And I would just sit there and drink my glass of wine. And he would come home, and he'd be like, how much did you have to drink? And I'd be like, oh, I only had a glass. And it started with that, and then gradually progressed, and there'd be those mystery bruises, you know, those mystery bruises where you're like, where the hell did that come from the next morning? And I would look like I was beat up, and I would black out, and I would come to, and I would just see that look on his face, that look that they give us, and I wouldn't remember what had happened. And I know that my daughter would sit there and she would kind of flinch if I came near her. And I didn't know what was going on. You know, somebody, we were talking about bathroom floors right before I came up here. A lot of bathroom floors, and I was a closet peer. I don't know if there's any other closet peers. I know you just can't find the bathroom for some reason. And there I am peeing in the closet. And then the arrests started. Okay, so recently I had to try to clean up my record. The state of California, the Department of Rehabilitation, has granted me a certified nursing assistant license. Thank you. at the age of 53, and they came back with one page, this was just recently, a whole page of the arrests and a whole page of everything that they wanted after that. And 93 was a really bad year for me, and apparently so it was like 2002, 2003. And my arrests with alcohol all look like DUIs or assaults. I'm an Irish-English-German girl, so you know what? I like to drink and I like to fight. And so, you know, the arrests started and things got really serious. In the meantime, my husband, he had relapsed and he's back on the opioids. And we're losing everything around us and there's nothing I can do. And my daughter would sit there and she would say to me, she'd say, "Mommy, please don't drink anymore." And I would tell her, you know, okay, all right, but tomorrow, right? And she would, I'd have her in her car seat in the car and I'd stop at the liquor store and she'd say, "Just a little bottle, Mommy." Because she knew that the big bottle meant trouble. Right? And in the meantime, I'm flipping around to different liquor stores, as we do, because I know that they're keeping track of what's going on over here. And I'd walk into the liquor store, and Omar would look at me, and he would just say, "What size?" Because he knew it was a Stoli, and because it tastes good warm. I was drinking vodka, and then I was concerned about it. I was like, you know, maybe it's the potato. Atkins was the diet at the time, and I was like, maybe it's the potato that's the problem. And so I switched to whiskey, and apparently I must have a gluten allergy too, because whiskey wasn't doing it. We won't even talk about tequila. Oh my gosh. And you know, the wine was giving me headaches, and the wine got cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, as did me, you know. And then the hallucinations started. You know, where all of a sudden you're seeing things, and I would hear this little radio playing somewhere. I'd hear music, and I was like, "Where is that little sound coming from?" Not realizing that I had, you know, progressed to that point in my alcoholism. And at that point, somebody stepped in, DCFS stepped in, and our daughter was taken away from us. And rightfully so, I was a bad mother. I was a bad mother. And the first time that I heard a woman say that from the podium, I was just like, it took my breath away, because I thought, oh my gosh, you know, that's me. That's me. And how can she say that? And our daughter was taken away from us for 2 years, and every single day I'd sit there and I'd say, okay, well, tomorrow I'll get her. Tomorrow it'll be okay. Tomorrow I'll get her. And days turned into weeks, and weeks turned into months, and months turned into years. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I came on a court card. I'd come before on court cards, but I came through a treatment program. And I was facing 18 months in prison. My daughter had been taken away from me. I had a suspended license. And I was going through, and my marriage was destroyed. And, but, you know, I still wasn't quite sure that, you know, that this was for me. And there was a counselor in that treatment program, and he had said, you know, because I was like, I would raise my hand and say, well, AA doesn't work. And I'm a perfect example. It doesn't work. I've been there millions of times. Doesn't work. And he would say, but Sarah, have you done all 12 steps? And I hadn't. I'd say, but. And he'd go, but have you done all 12 steps? And I hadn't. And I took note of that. I bookmarked that one. And when I got out of that treatment program, instead of trying to go back to that marriage, I had to leave that marriage to be able to get sober, because I was either going to go to prison or I was going to die in that house. I went to sober living. I did the whole sober living thing. I did the telemarketing thing, because now I'm an ex-felon. I had 3 years of mandatory probation where I had to pee in a cup forever. And you know, the unmanageability part. I knew that I was an alcoholic, but I hadn't quite grasped the second part of the first step, the unmanageability. I still thought I could manage things. You know, I still thought I could control things. I still thought I could manage things. And I couldn't. And that's when I found my sponsor, Carla. I was sponsor shopping because, of course, don't you know, my case is so difficult, so different. I'm so terribly unique. I'm sponsor shopping, and she spoke the language of the heart. She spoke about the disease of alcoholism. She talked about a solution. She talked about those things about, like, you know, not being able to pick up the phone and answer those hard phone calls from her daughter, like, when are you going to come and get me? And I realized that I was in deep trouble. And she terrified me, but, you know, I got her phone number from the speaker getter, and I called her the next morning. And to this day, I can tell you exactly where I was on the freeway. I asked her if she would sponsor me, and she said, are you willing to go to any lengths for your sobriety? And that just shook me, you know. She said it with such conviction. Now, I wanted to be sober. I just didn't know that I wanted to be that sober, you know. With the serenity prayer on the wall, and, you know, all of that. And, somehow, yes flew out of my mouth, and that was God working in my life right then and there. And I remember looking at my new ex-convict boyfriend and thinking, well, there goes he. And she had told me, she goes, give me 9 steps to the best of your ability, and I promise your life will change. My first thought was, oh, yay, only 9 steps, because I'm a half measures girl. And I didn't quite get it. It was like, whoo, over my head. And she said that, you know, we have a mountain to climb and you don't have to do that alone. And then she took over my life. I couldn't do anything right. So she would hang up on me all the time, and then I would just go and I would do the work, and I would come back and be like, I did it. And she would just smile on the other end of the phone. And she had a work cut out for me. I was not an ideal. I was so angry my first year. I was so angry. I was bitter. I was a victim. And then she taught me, victim or volunteer, victim or volunteer. I'm sorry, how did he get in there? Oh, you let him in? You know, sounds to me like you don't trust this person, you know, because my wallet's gone yet again, because it's another one of those boys with potential. And, oh my God. So, it took me about a year before she actually said, you know what? I think that's a good idea. That sounds like a good idea, you know? And I was like, yes, because I would run everything by her. And nothing, it just seemed like I was a grown woman, but I just absolutely just had no clue, obviously, about living or anything else. And we went through that book line by line, word by word. And she took me through those steps, right? And I did have one last final relapse. I had 18 months of sobriety, and I would like to blame him for the relapse, the newcomer that had negative sobriety, that had a lot of potential and was a rocker. And but he even said months into it, he goes, you knew what you were getting into. I was like, oh, shoot, he's so right. What happened was I didn't share it with her. I kept it a secret. My sexual misconduct got me in trouble yet one more time because I did not tell her. And by not telling her, and by going to different meetings, the hip, slick, and cool LA meetings, you know, that they hold in bars and where the movie stars are and what it was like and what she wore, those types of meetings, I pushed A away and I pushed my God away. And so I had no mental defense against that first drink. And this was the big changer for me, was that when I had that last relapse, normally when I would take a drink, my first thought would be like, oh, why did you wait so long? That sense of ease and comfort would come over me. But this time when I took that drink, I instantly went into fear. And my first thought was like, oh my God, what have I done? And I watched the big book come alive, right? Because it still took me 6 months to get back. The phenomenon of craving, the obsession of the mind, the spiritual malady. I watched all of that unfold. Claire S. was speaking at a meeting, and I was drunk. I was next to my sponsor. If you're drunk and you're in this meeting, hats off to you. I love you. You know, it's like I couldn't get this, and so I was showing up to meetings drunk. I was drunk. I was at the meeting. And Clara spoke, and in the middle of her talk, she talked about being too afraid of living and too afraid of dying. And that was right where I was. I was too chicken to step in front of the bus, right? or to jump off that building. And I thought about it many, many times. I just could not find the way out. And I just couldn't see living like that anymore. I was throwing up blood. I couldn't get the alcohol in me anymore. I had lost God. I couldn't look anybody in the face. I risked losing my daughter all over again. And when she said that, something clicked. And in that moment of grace, God stepped back in. And I straightened out my affairs. Sorry, I get really emotional about it. I checked into rehab that Monday, and I've been sober ever since. Right? And I got really, really busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started sponsoring at 6 months of sobriety. I got into service. I did H&I work. I did everything. I did the parties, the dances, the camping trips, all the lame stuff that I was doing. You're like, no, that's me. They'd be like, are you going to Mountain High? I'd be like, no, that's for you. I did everything. I signed up for it. Just sign me up. Yes, I was the escrow. Yes, I'll do it. I'll cover all the commitments, everybody, you know? At 2 years of sobriety, I became a GSR. I had no idea what I was doing. I was terrified to get up in front of people, but I learned how to do that, you know. At 3 years of sobriety, I had some other life-changing things. One of my sponsees, I was no longer sponsoring it. I had to let her go. She committed suicide or overdose. I'd like to think that she basically, you know, that she had just thought it was a cry for help. And just overdid it. And that struck me really hard. And within another week, a close friend of mine that I'd known for a long time died. And when she was on her deathbed, she sat there. And we had known each other for years. And it was cancer. But when you looked up on the medical board, it said methadone still up there with her meds. And so I knew it wasn't cancer that was killing her. It was her alcoholism and her addiction. And she turned to me and she goes, that was it. That was my life. Just that constant struggle to get sober in and out of the rooms. And at that point, I changed. I was like, you know what, damn it, I'm tired of being miserable in AA. You know, I'm gonna go have some fun, right? And I really dove deeper and deeper and deeper into this program. I saw the promises come true. Right? The nine-step promises, what they don't tell you is that they come true again and again and again at deeper levels. I've had moments of unbearable joy. Unbearable joy. Now, mind you, I'm a girl that likes to get there, right? I have, you know, my friend Rhonda talks about, you know, forget about the overdose. We're worried about the deadly underdose. I've had moments, spiritual experiences, that were vastly more than anything that I could have ever gotten externally, and it came from within. And, you know, when I made my amends to my mother, she was just before her dementia, and, well, her dementia had kicked in, and she had told me, she said, you know, I know that you thought I was a really crappy mom. And I thought you were a pretty crappy daughter, too. But you sure are making up for last time. She knew. She knew. And what I didn't know is that by helping her through that and by making the amends to my mother and showing up like Alcoholics Anonymous told me how to do, that I would gain a relationship with that father. Right? I did get my daughter back. Somebody in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous helped me do the paperwork so that I could get that little girl back. And that person that helped me do the paperwork to get my little girl back knew how to do the paperwork because she had tried to get her kids back unsuccessfully, but she didn't let that hold her back from helping another. That's what we do here. We help one another through thick and thin. I met my husband in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in line to thank the speaker, just saying. And he asked for permission to court me from my sponsor. We also joke about that he was going to check out to make sure I wasn't crazy. but he was a real man. It wasn't somebody that had potential. He had already, you know, gained that. and you know, we took our time with this. And we have a rich, wonderful life, right? I measure my success in so many other ways than I used to, you know, And our house is filled with Alcoholics Anonymous. There are sponsees usually all over the place. I sponsor a lot of women. The worse your case, the more I love you. And people send them to me all the time because I love that. My sponsor didn't give up on me. I don't give up on them, right? And, you know, our house is just filled with the principles of the program, right? Trust, honesty, respect for one another, respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. So 2 years ago, 3 years ago actually, it was our wedding anniversary, we did a DNA test. And my father popped up. My father didn't know. I was adopted in a time where you just didn't have illegitimate children back in 1966. My mother had never told my father about me. He didn't know I existed. And there on Ancestry.com, I was sitting at work. I opened up an email and it said parent-child match. And I reached out. And I have a father today. And I have two sisters, two half-sisters. One who, I remember when I got the phone call and realized that this was really happening, that he was still alive. And he said, you know, my stepmother was on the phone. And she said, and I go, do I have any siblings? And she goes, you have two sisters. She goes, well, the bad news is, and I was waiting for her to say that one of them had passed away. And she goes, well, Elizabeth, she's an addict, and she's been homeless for 17 years. And I thought, oh, that's no problem. And guess what? Within, I guess it was about 9 months, we had her tracked down, and she's now in an apartment. She's through the PATH Foundation in San Diego, and she has a mental illness. I don't know if she'll ever be well, but I was able to be a sister. And my stepmother had said, you know, I'm so sorry that we're the family that you found. And I was like, oh, well, Elena prepared me for that one. As well did AA. And, you know, and my father had said, you know, I wish we would have found you earlier. And all I could think of was, thank God you didn't. Right? God had a plan. That had been my dream, that missing puzzle piece that I had as a little girl. It was finally there, and I was whole. And then I realized that it wasn't that that made me whole, that made me complete. You had made me whole. You had made me complete. You had sitting there and given me a God that I could rely on. You know, God used to be the last thing that I would go to. I loved it. People would sit there and go, well, have you prayed about it? Have you prayed about it? I'd be like, no. And God became the first thing. And to this day, God is the first thing that I turn to now. And the life that I have is because of that. And I thank all of you so much for the life I have today. Thank you.
Give Sarah another round of applause.